Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to cover in this audio Ecclesiastes chapter 2, which I will call Pleasures, Wisdom, and Toil Are Meaningless. Solomon continues his litany of despair, some would say cynicism. We start now in Ecclesiastes 2, verses 1 through 3. Solomon says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly, until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. The few years of their lives. Life expectancy was probably shorter in Solomon's time than it is today, but it doesn't matter how long one's life expectancy is. Life is short, as the saying goes. Now, in verse 1, Solomon says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you. Why is he testing himself? He's trying to find the meaning of life, because everything is vanity and striving after the wind, as he said in the last chapter. Now, he says, I'm going to test you, meaning test himself, with pleasure, to see if pleasure will give him the meaning of life. Natural wisdom has failed to give him pleasure, but if you recall, even in the last chapter, even wisdom didn't give him a purpose and meaning in life. And this was the man who had written 3,000 proverbs and was considered the wisest man in the world. But that didn't satisfy him, along with all the gardens he built, the palaces he built, all the money he had, all the concubines he had. None of that helped him. And so now he's going to try pleasure. Now, this pleasure that he's going to test himself with does not refer to sordid lusts and pleasures. As John Gill says, Solomon was too wise and good to give in to that. It refers rather to rational and lawful pleasures. We know that because in verse 3, Solomon says, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine. We know that because in verse 3, Solomon said, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely. He's not drunk out of his mind. So we can assume in verse 2, when Solomon said, I said of laughter, it is madness, he's referring to laughter used in a moderate way and kept within due bounds. Now, that kind of laughter is good. It conduces to the health of the body and the pleasure of the mind. But when laughter is used on every trivial occasion and indulged to excess, it is mere madness and makes a man look more like a madman and a fool. It lasts but for a while, and the end of it is heaviness. Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 6, For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool, and this too is futility. When you burn thorn bushes under a pot, they disappear very quickly. The laughter of a fool will likewise disappear very quickly. It is futile, it is vain, it is meaningless. And Solomon himself said in Proverbs 14, 13, Even in laughter the heart may be in pain, and the end of joy may be grief. A lot of people laugh, even while they're crying on the inside. There are a lot of lyrics of popular songs that allude to that, the face smiling on the outside and pain on the inside. I can't think of any right now, but I know I've been acquainted with such songs. So Solomon is not condemning here reasonable laughter. He's condemning foolish laughter, as John Gill says. The wise Solomon would not make a trial of foolish laughter. He wouldn't say, I'm going to test myself to see if I can get some happiness and meaning out of foolish laughter. Get drunk and start laughing hysterically like the class clown or like the fool at a drunken party. No. But Solomon didn't think good laughter was madness. Proverbs 15:13. Solomon says, A joyful heart makes a cheerful face, but when the heart is sad, the spirit is broken. And he says in Proverbs 17, verse 22, A joyful heart is good medicine, but a broken spirit dries up the bones. So there's nothing wrong with laughing from a joyful heart. Solomon is not condemning that. So he's probably condemning wild, raucous, stupid laughter. But on the other hand, he might be speaking of moderate laughter here because he's testing himself with pleasure, with wine, while his mind was guiding him wisely, as verse 3 says, so maybe he's talking about moderate laughter. But it doesn't really make any difference. It doesn't make whether it's the laughter of a fool or the laughter of somebody who has a cheerful heart. It's still madness. It's not helpful to him. The word madness makes me think the laughter Solomon is talking about here is crazy laughter, but we'll just say even if it's helpful laughter, moderate laughter, it's still madness. It doesn't bring any meaning in life. And the pleasure he's talking about here is not wild pleasure like at a frat party or a sorority gathering. He's talking about the type of hedonism that John Piper talks about when he talks about Christian hedonism, enjoying God. Because Solomon knows that he's going to die. And so it's all vanity and striving after the wind. That's why he says in verse 3, he wants to see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. We go now to Ecclesiastes 2, verses 4 through 6. Solomon says, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. So Solomon, still looking for meaning in life, decides he's going to be a botanist and an architect. When Solomon says, I built houses for myself, he's probably referring to his own palace, not the temple, as John Gill suggests. And that was an awesome palace. We read about that in the book of Kings. It was lavish. It was luxurious. Then he planted vineyards for himself. Perhaps those vineyards at Engedi were his vineyards. Engedi, of course, was that oasis halfway down from north to south on the western coast of the Dead Sea. We read in Solomon's Song of Songs, my beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of Engedi. So maybe he planted those vineyards. Doesn't say so, but maybe he did. In the Song of Songs 8, verse 11, Solomon says, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. Ooh, that's a fruitful vineyard. Well, where is Baal Haman? BibleStudyTools.com says the word means place of a multitude, a place where Solomon had an extensive vineyard. It has been supposed to be identical with Baal Gad and also with Haman in the tribe of Asher. Others identify it with Belamon in central Palestine near Dothaim. Well, I don't know where those places are. It doesn't matter. The point is that Solomon had a luxurious vineyard, and it still didn't make him happy. His vineyard was probably bigger than anybody else's vineyard. But to what avail? He made gardens for himself, a king's garden. Jeremiah 39, verse 4 says this, when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and all the men of war saw them, the Babylonians, they fled and went out of the city at night by way of the king's garden through the gate between the two walls, and he went out toward the Araba. That was at the south of the city of David, Mount Zion. There was a double wall down there. You had to go through that double wall to get out into the Kidron Valley. The Araba, of course, is the Jordan Valley, which extends all the way from the Sea of Galilee down to the tip, Eilat, at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. So Zedekiah goes out by the king's garden. John Gill says, as Solomon was so great a botanist and knew the nature and use of all kinds of trees and herbs, no doubt but he has a herbal garden well stocked with everything of that kind, curious and useful. Still didn't make him happy, though. In verse 5, Solomon says, I planted in all these gardens and parks he made. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. And many of these fruit trees were probably bought from foreign parts because Solomon had a worldwide trade going on. In verse 6, Solomon says, I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. Some speculations as to where these ponds were. There was something called the King's Pool near the Fountain Gate, Nehemiah 2:14. Nehemiah says, then I passed on to the Fountain Gate and the King's Pool. The Fountain Gate is probably at the southern tip of Mount Zion, probably led to En Rogel, which is a well on the south of Mount Zion, and the Fountain Gate probably led there, according to ChristianStudyLibrary.org. And the King's Pool, capitalized in the NASB, the King's Pool, capital K, capital P, that might very well have been Solomon who built that thing. Or he could be referring to the fish pools at Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabim, referred to in the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, chapter 7, verse 4. Solomon says of his love, your neck is like a tower of ivory, your eyes like the pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabim. Well, I don't know where the gate of Bathrabbim is, but Heshbon is near Mount Peor, which is right near Mount Pisgah where Moses died, in Moab, northeast of the Dead Sea. Perhaps these fish pools belonged to Solomon, and that's what he's referring to. Another speculation is that there are a set of pools about a league, that's 1.4 miles, from Bethlehem. Great reservoirs are cut into the rock, one reservoir at the end of the other, the second being a little lower than the first, and a third a little lower than the second, and so the waters communicate from one to another when those reservoirs are full. John Gill says Solomon is supposed to allude to these pools about 1.5 miles from Bethlehem. But there's another possibility. Jameson Fawcett and Brown point out that three reservoirs are still found called Solomon's Cisterns, 1.5 miles from Jerusalem. So nobody knows, but the point is Solomon engaged in agricultural landscaping as well as building pleasure palaces. But it did make him happy. We move now to Ecclesiastes 2, verses 7 through 9. I bought male and female slaves, Solomon said, and I had home-born slaves. Also I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also I collected for myself silver and gold in the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. So Solomon is now continuing his litany of advantages he had. He had male and female slaves to take care of his drudgery, his work. He also had homeborn slaves. Those were children that were born of his married slaves. Why does Solomon especially mention them? Probably because they were more esteemed and more trustworthy than slaves who had been bought. That's because they'd been raised up in the home and had been trained better. Solomon says he has flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me. That means all the kings that came before him. They might have been rich, but he was richer. Verse 8, he collected for himself silver and gold. Now let's look at some mention of Solomon's wealth in 1 Kings 9 and 10. 1 Kings 9, 14, and Hiram, that's Hiram of Tyre, sent to the king 120 talents of gold. 1 Kings 9, 28. They went to Ophir, and Ophir is probably, nobody knows for sure, is probably down there on the coast of Saudi Arabia, probably the southwest coast, kind of where Yemen is, but nobody knows. They went to Ophir and took 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to King Solomon. 1 Kings 10, 14. Now the weight of gold which came into Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, the number of the beast. 1 Kings 10, 22. For the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish. That's probably in Spain. Nobody knows for sure. For the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks. 1 Kings 10, 27. King made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem, and he made cedars as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lowland. Solomon was the Bill Gates of ancient Israel. He was loaded. He was probably as rich as Elon Musk is. Elon Musk, of course, is the richest man in the world. Now, in verse 8, we have a translation problem. Solomon says he has male and female singers and concubines, which refers to the pleasures of men. Well, the NIV footnote at this place says the meaning of the Hebrew for this phrase is uncertain. It's uncertain whether the Hebrew means concubines. Other translations have it this way, musical instruments for the pleasure of men. The ESV, the KJV, and the New King James Version all have musical instruments. The Douay-Rheims Catholic Version has, Solomon had cups and vessels to pour out wine for the pleasures of men. The easy-to-read version says Solomon had everything anyone could want, which is a little bit loose. But most of the translations have concubines or the equivalent, so we'll take it as concubines. Solomon had 300 of those in addition to 700 wives. I mean, if that's not going to make a man happy, what is? Well, of course, it can be said that 1,000 wives would tend to make one miserable. But at any rate, it didn't make Solomon happy. Verse 9, he says, then I became great. In fact, having concubines and wives was a symbol of power for kings. The more concubines they had, the more political power they had. Then I, Solomon, became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. That would be all the kings that came before him, including the great King David. My wisdom also stood by me. He was famous for Proverbs. He had wisdom too. He had everything. He had it all. But he still wasn't happy. We go to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 10 through 11. Solomon continues, "All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun." So Solomon works like a dog, and he uses the money he made to buy all these things to give him pleasure, the parks, the houses, the cedar trees, the ponds, the pools, the concubines, the musical instruments, the food, all was vanity and striving after the wind. In verse 10, when Solomon says, "My heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor," it means all the things that his eyes did not refuse. He had the money from working, and so he had plenty of money, and he could see something and buy it. And he did. He didn't refuse anything. So Solomon worked hard and played hard, but he still did not find the meaning to life. We move now to Ecclesiastes 2, verses 12 through 16. Solomon continues, "So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die." In verse 12, Solomon says, "So I turned to consider wisdom." Turn from what? Well, Solomon had earlier turned from the pursuit of wisdom to pursue natural pleasures at the beginning of chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, and having not been satisfied by pleasure, he's turned back to wisdom again. He not only considered wisdom, but he considered the opposite of wisdom, madness and folly, and that makes sense. If you want to look at success, you can look at its opposite, failure, and learn about success. Same thing with wisdom and madness and folly. As John Gill says, Solomon determined to look more narrowly and penetrate into the secrets of wisdom and find out the nature of it and examine its contraries, that by setting them in a contrast and comparing them together, he might be the better able to form a judgment of them. In other words, Solomon is contrasting wisdom with folly. "For what will the man do who comes after Solomon?" Solomon asked in verse 12. That could refer to Solomon's successor, Rehoboam. Or it could refer to any man in general, and I think that's what it does refer to, any man. And what Solomon is saying, there ain't nobody has had all the money and the pleasure and the wisdom and the gardens and the ponds and the palace and the money and the concubines and the slaves that I've had. So I'm the extreme example of the man who's got it all, and I'm still not happy. In verse 13, Solomon says that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. Light, of course, is pleasant and delightful. It is useful to guide one on his path. Light sometimes symbolizes joy and prosperity, as Gill says. So wisdom is compared to all of that, compared to light. And darkness, of course, is uncomfortable. It's unsafe to walk in. It's used as a symbol for adversity. Things are dark around here. Well, wisdom excels folly as much as light excels darkness. And so Solomon says that wisdom is a good thing. But he's really making an a fortiori argument. It's good, but it still doesn't make me happy. It's not the ultimate good. Verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head. What does Solomon mean by that? It means he can see where he's going. But the fool walks in darkness. He can't see where he's going. And Solomon then says at the end of verse 14, yet I know that one fate befalls them both. And that fate, of course, is death. The wise man or the fool are both going to die. So what's the point of being wise? Now, of course, if you have a worldview that focuses only on this life, which all atheists and agnostics and non-believers in God do because they don't believe in the afterlife, not really. So they focus on this life and then no matter how well they do, they're going to die. Steve Jobs died of liver cancer. I mean, it doesn't matter how rich you are. You're going to die, whether you're wise or whether you're a fool. So Solomon's saying, what's the point of being extremely wise? He says, actually, in verse 15, why then have I been extremely wise? What's the point? I'm going to die. My fate's going to be the same fate as the fool. So I said to myself, this too is vanity. What is vanity? Wisdom. Verse 16, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Now, Solomon could mean that people don't remember or call to mind wise people in this life as his memory fades as he gets older, or he could be referring to after he dies. And that's true. Most inventors, most philosophers are lost to history. Now, there's a few that have not been lost to history. We still remember Plato and Aristotle. But in general, what Solomon says is exactly true. Think of all these wise people in the academy. I like to read history books and philosophy books. I used to, and I read these philosophers that nobody's ever heard of, except the people in that narrow field, maybe even the people in his own department. But he's a very wise man, writing all kinds of deep stuff. It doesn't matter. He's dead now. Who remembers him? Nobody. It's all a waste of time from the viewpoint of eternity. Why? Because as Solomon says at the end of verse 16, how the wise man and the fool alike die. Looked at in the long run, there's no difference between being a moron and being a philosopher of wisdom. Solomon goes on to verses 17 through 19 of chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. Solomon said, so I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility in striving after wind. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Under the sun, of course, means in this life. Solomon says, I've acted wisely in this life, and I've made a lot of money, and I've accomplished a lot of stuff. What good's it going to do me? I'm going to die and leave it to my son. And his son was Rehoboam, who was a fool. He completely mismanaged his kingship and ended up splitting the nation of Israel into the northern and southern kingdoms because he refused to lower the taxes on the northern tribes. Think about that. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and the only son he managed to come up with was Rehoboam, who was an idiot. Maybe Solomon, having looked at Rehoboam, maybe he figured that all of his wealth and wisdom was going to come to naught when he says, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Maybe he's thinking Rehoboam in particular, and he knows that Rehoboam is going to be a disaster. He leaves it open in verse 19. He says, who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? But maybe he had a strong intimation that his son Rehoboam was going to be a fool. Rehoboam is going to have control over all that Solomon built, all those ponds and gardens and palaces, and gold and silver. Now, Solomon himself was not exactly wise. He's noted for all of his wisdom and his proverbs. But remember, he turned his heart away from God and went chasing after the idols of his concubines and wives. Let's read what Solomon's father David said to him as he was dying, 1 Chronicles 28, verse 9. As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father, that's Yahweh, the God of Solomon's father David, and serve him with a whole heart and a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will let you find him. But if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. And of course, Solomon did reject God. Now, he was rejected forever. That doesn't mean he went to hell. Forever can just mean a long time. As Brown, Driver, and Briggs' Hebrew lexicon says of the Hebrew word la'ad, it's not holam there, but la'ad or le'ad. I don't. It's probably le'ad. I don't know how to pronounce it. But this is what Brown, Driver, and Briggs says about it. During the lifetime of a king, and that lexicon quotes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 verses in Psalms and Proverbs. So, Solomon is rejected during his lifetime because of his idolatry and stupidity. So he's wanting to be talking about his son, those who come after him, squandering all the stuff he's built up. Solomon himself squandered a lot of his spiritual legacy. Maybe that's why he was worried about what his own son was going to do, because he saw what he had done in his life. We go now to Ecclesiastes 2, verses 20 through 23. Solomon continues, "Therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, has not labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. This too is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity." Solomon lay on his bed at night, and his mind is churning, thinking about all of his trouble. Sounds like he couldn't leave it at the office. I remember I have told myself in the past that I need to rest in peace. Jesus said, "Sufficient are today of the worries thereof." And if I'm thinking about it at night and I can't sleep, then I'm worrying, and worry is a sin. So my standard is, can I sleep through the night peacefully all night long without thinking about all the garbage that's happened out there? In other words, can my mind rest and not churn at night? That takes the work of the Holy Spirit. My mind can't do that, not on its own. So Solomon, verse 20, says he is completely despaired. He has completely given up on his search for wisdom, pleasure, and building great works. It's all vanity, meaningless, futile. We go now to Ecclesiastes 2, verses 24 through 26, and we will finish chapter 2. Solomon continues, "There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he is given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind." Now these three verses are a little more difficult to understand than the rest of the chapter. And just as an overview here, I think what Solomon is doing is saying, look, I'm not saying that wisdom is bad or that labor is bad or that eating is bad. Done and accepted from the hand of God, done by the hand of God and accepted from him, that's fine. But Solomon is making an a fortiori argument. If this cannot last forever, these good things coming from God, this good labor, this good joy, this good wisdom, this good food, this good drink, if that is not going to be permanent, if that is going to be vanity and striving after the wind because we're all going to die, well, then everything else is going to be bad too. There's nothing that can satisfy us in this life. I think that's a reasonable summary of what Solomon is saying here. Well, let's start and go through it a little more carefully. Verse 24, "There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink." And of course, that means moderately, not intemperately. "There's nothing better for a man to tell himself that his labor is good." That is true. There's nothing more satisfying than working hard at something and seeing the fruit of your labor. It's a human thing. And eating and drinking, some of the best pleasures of life is eating good food, drinking good wine. Nothing wrong with all that, as long as you do it in moderation and do not end up being a glutton or a drunkard. And as long as you labor in moderation and don't destroy your family and don't become a workaholic and destroy your health, well, all of that's good. It's from the hand of God. Verse 25, Solomon says, "Who can eat? Who can have enjoyment without him?" Which implies that with him, you can eat and have enjoyment if you do it with him. Of course, if people don't do it with God, they end up being drunkards and gluttons and workaholics. But if you do it with God, you can enjoy it. And so, verse 26, "For a person who is good in God's sight, God has given him wisdom and knowledge and joy." That's fine. That's wonderful. Solomon was big on wisdom and knowledge. He wrote the whole book of Proverbs. Plus, he had 3,000 total Proverbs in addition. Or in the total of his Proverbs, including the book of Proverbs, equaled 3,000. And on the other hand, the sinner works hard so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. So the sinner works, he loses his wealth. The sinner works and loses his wealth, and the righteous man gains wealth. Now, I'm not exactly sure of the mechanism of how that happens, but in general, Solomon's saying that what happens. For example, in Proverbs 28:8, Solomon says, "Whoever increases his wealth through excessive interest collects it for one who is kind to the poor." Now, how that happens, I don't know. I guess it's through the providence of God. Now, Solomon says at the very end of the chapter, "This too is vanity in striving after the wind." It's not clear what he's talking about. It's not clear what the reference is when he speaks of vanity and striving after the wind. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Solomon does recognize that there are good things from God. In 2 Chronicles 1, verses 11 through 12, we read this, God said to Solomon, because you had this in mind and did not ask for riches. Remember in verse 10, Solomon asked God, grant me wisdom and knowledge so that I may lead these people. And God says to Solomon, because you had this in mind and did not ask for riches, wealth, or honor, or the life of those who hate you, nor have you even asked for long life, but you have asked for yourself wisdom and knowledge that you may rule my people over whom I have made you king. Wisdom and knowledge have been granted to you, says God to Solomon, and I will give you riches and wealth and honor such as none of the kings who were before you has possessed, nor those who will come after you. So you see, Solomon didn't really lust after money or power, fame. It came to him because he had turned his life over to God at the beginning. Now, unfortunately, the money, the power, and the fame seduced him away from God at the end of his life, but he started out not looking for riches and wealth and honor for himself, but rather for wisdom. So, that brings us to the last part of verse 26, when Solomon says, this too is vanity and striving after the wind. There are two options as to how we can interpret that. What is vanity and striving after the wind? Option number one, it refers to the travail and work of the sinner. Because in the middle of verse 26, Solomon says, to the sinner, God has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. That, too, is vanity, which means that you work hard all your life and somebody else gets your money. But option number two, the option which I prefer and which the Cambridge commentary agrees with, the thing that Solomon thought was vanity and striving after the wind was the measure of joy attainable by him who is good in the sight of God. At the beginning of verse 26, for to a person who is good in God's sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy, and that's good, but in the long run, it's vanity and striving after the wind. A fortiori argument. It's good, but it's not good enough. The commentators split on that. My opinion is that Solomon is saying, man, it doesn't even matter if you're good and you're wise. He earlier said, the fool and the wise man die, they end up in the same boat. So going along with that idea is, being wise is not good enough to make one understand the mysteries of life. So ladies and gentlemen, we're now finished with Ecclesiastes 2. We're now prepared to go in our next audio to Ecclesiastes 3, which I will entitle A Time for Everything. Remember the bird song, there is a season, there is a time. Turn, 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 that great song. Well, they got it from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, which we will look at in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.